boys and sex and conflicting cultural messages. Author Peggy Orenstein is best known for her work about the inner lives and cultural expectations of girls. But her most recent project is about boys, specifically teenage boys and young men. For her new book, Boys and Sex, Young Men on Hookups, Love, Porn, Consent, and Navigating the New Masculinity, Orenstein interviewed more than 100 teenagers and young adults about very intimate experiences and feelings. What she found is that boys are navigating a difficult, complex, and often disturbing culture, and that we need to talk to boys about sex more often and differently. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on Maine Calling, author Peggy Orenstein joins us to talk about her findings. We'll also hear from local educators working to improve communication and reduce sexual assault. Maine Calling is next, but first, this news update. From the Maine Public Radio studios, I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. In this Me Too era, the topic of young men and sex is more charged than ever. Today, we'll talk about what young men think about sex and intimacy and how it relates to male identity. Joining us from WBEZ in Chicago is best-selling author Peggy Orenstein. Her latest book is titled Boys and Sex, Young Men on Hookups, Love, Porn, Consent, and Navigating the New Masculinity. Some of her other books have explored girls and their views on sex, as well as female identity, including Girls and Sex and Schoolgirls, Young Women's Self-Esteem and the Confidence Gap. Joining me in our Portland studio is Catherine Buxton. She's communications manager for Speak About It, a nonprofit organization here in Maine that educates young people about preventing sexual violence. As always, we want to hear from you. Are you wondering how to discuss sexual issues with your son? Email talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, post on Facebook, or give us a call, 1-800-399-3566. Peggy, thank you so much for joining us. You've written famously about girls for years, and now you've turned to boys. Why did you shift to the male perspective for this book?
You know, it wasn't something I ever thought I'd do. It was really not on my to-do list. But after I published Girls and Sex, everywhere I went, parents, girls, boys themselves said, when are you going to talk? When are you going to talk to boys? When are you going to write about boys? And I was sort of resistant. I thought, you know, not sure that's my thing. But the more I thought about it, the more I realized that nobody was talking to boys and nobody was hearing from them, especially in a new era, about sex, about intimacy, and about masculinity. So I decided to go out and talk to, as you said at the top of the hour, over 100 guys all over the country who were either college-bound or in college. And along the way, Me Too exploded. And so then suddenly there was this urgency to, you know, the scope of sexual violence was just glaringly apparent, and the scope of misconduct in every sector of society. So there was this imperative to reduce sexual violence. But I also became very excited because it felt like a real opportunity to engage young men in the kind of conversations that we need to around sex, around intimacy, around masculinity.
One of the things that really struck me about your book is that over and over again, boys and young men are telling you things that they're saying that they have never confided to anyone. And that in and of itself is part of the issue, right? That nobody talks, nobody communicates.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, another fear I had was that boys wouldn't talk, that I would have a lot of transcripts consisting of, you know, and that wasn't true at all. They were really eager to talk about their sexual experience, about anxiety, about concerns, about what sexual misconduct was, and particularly about the thing that boys are never supposed to talk about, which is their feelings.
Catherine, does this resonate with you in the work that Speak About It does? Do you find that boys haven't talked to anyone but desperately need to?
You know, the name of our organization is Speak About It, and we foster conversation. So we use performance and dialogue to really open that conversational line with students of all genders. And while we find that sometimes boys are initially hesitant to talk to us in a classroom setting because a lot of our educators are young people, so folks between the age of 19 and 25. Boys and girls seem to be more inherently willing to open up about these conversations. And what we hear most often across gender lines often is this is the first time anyone has come to their school or their campus or in their lives and had these frank and honest discussions. And so we're getting a lot of students who are exploring these issues verbally out loud with their peers for the first time or for one of the first times. And so there's a nervousness about that, but also a hunger and deep desire to keep that conversation going. And that fills us with a lot of hope.
Mm. Peggy, one of the things, I'm going to misquote you here, but you say parents would rather stick a fork in their eye than talk to their sons about sex and sexuality. But hasn't that always been the case? You know, parents have always had a hard time talking to their kids and their sons about these issues. What is different today?
We just don't have the luxury of that silence anymore. And I think while certain behaviors have always been around, boys are now growing up with profoundly mixed messages, where on one hand, they're being told only yes means yes, they're being told to practice and value consent, and yet they're steeped in a sexualized media that's then reinforced by pornography. And even though they have all these sort of new ideas about what masculinity means, that, you know, you have female friends, you see girls as equals on the playing field, you see girls as equal in the classroom, they're still wrestling with all those old ideas about masculinity that stresses sexual conquest and emotional stoicism and all those old values. So they're living in this contradictory culture. And, you know, if we don't talk to them about these issues, frankly, the media is going to educate them for us.
And you say that many parents will say to their boys, always treat girls with respect. But
doesn't
go much further than that. Respect women. And we think we know what we mean when we talk to boys about this, but they don't know what we mean, correct?
Right. Boys would tell me that I think the typical length of the amount of time that parents tend to talk to their sons about sex is 10 minutes and ever. And what they tend to say is some version of don't get anybody pregnant, don't get a disease, and respect women. And boys would say to me, you know, that's kind of like telling somebody not to run over any little old ladies and then handing them the car keys. You know, of course you think you're not going to run over any little old ladies, but you still don't know how to drive.
And some of the language, which was most shocking to me, some of the ways that boys talk about girls behind their backs, talk about sex behind their back, there's so much violent language that you discovered that boys use casually.
Well, yeah, boys learn, you know, the language they're supposed to use is they bang, they pound, they hammer, they nail, they pipe, they tap that, they hit that. You know, it sounds like they've been to a construction site, not like they've engaged in an act of intimacy. But I want to be clear that a lot of the guys weren't necessarily okay with that. They weren't telling me that to say, and that's cool. You know, they were struggling with how to confront and deal with that. So one guy told me, a boy that I call Cole in the book, talked to me about speaking up to older guys on his crew team with a friend of his who were saying, you know, gross things about girls. And they laughed at them and they mocked them. And the next time something happened, Cole stayed silent, which is really very much how boys learn to become men. And his friend continued to speak up. And he said, as he kept stepping up, and I kept stepping back, I saw that guys, you know, started liking him less and not listening to him, and he lost all his social capital. And I just had buckets left, but I wasn't spending it. And I don't know what to do. I don't know how to make it how, you know, I don't want to have to choose between my dignity and these guys, but how do I make it so I don't have to choose?
Mm. Do you find this, Catherine, that this sort of not just navigating the world of intimacy and sexuality, but navigating your place in the boy culture is something that young men that speak about it works with? Is this something they talk about?
This is absolutely something they talk about and something we engage them on. So my colleague Aronde Kruger, who spoke with Peggy yesterday at her book launch at Space Gallery, leads a lot of programs about gender, technology, media, and he does this activity where he says, okay, So pretend I'm a robot and I have to, as a robot, fit in with human boys. How do I behave? And they will say, okay, you like sports, you have short hair, you get angry really easily, you're hungry all the time, whether it's for sex or food. And there was a boy at one of these workshops who put his head on the table after this activity, and Aranda asked, what's wrong? Are you okay? And the boy lifted his head up and was like, I don't know. I just want to be more than hungry, angry, and horny. And this is a sentiment that we get from a lot of guys and oftentimes a lot of young women who also feel sort of that they live in their own box. And for particularly masculine folks who are raised as men, we like to point out to them that there's a lot of research around the fact that often you bring a group of young people or young men together and they will often assume that their peers are thinking the worst thing, or their peers want them to want them to use this bad language, but that they themselves would never do it. They themselves would never use these construction type terms that Peggy just referred to talk about women or talk about sex, but they're assuming everybody else does. And so we have these groups of young men who are all assuming that their peers are thinking the worst and acting the worst, and they feel this pressure to act that way, and yet this is an assembly of semi-decent young men who all feel like everyone else is sort of pressuring them to act that way when nobody actually in their hearts kind of wants to. And so it's this funny catch-22 almost of like, who's creating this masculine box and why are we all feeling forced into it?
Yeah, and Peggy, you talk about this. Catherine was talking about how these are good guys, but you also find that the same boys that to you are polite and honest and kind with their friends are talking about sexual conquest and objectifying girls and talking about keeping track of how many hookups they have.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, that's what in hookup culture and hookup can mean kind of anything. But hookup culture is the idea that some kind of sexual contact precedes a connection rather than deriving from emotional intimacy. And guys in hookup culture would often talk about it as kind of, you know, it's a competition with your other guys. You're kind of doing it for the invisible audience in the room. It's not really about the connection with the other person. And what, you know, the word vulnerable and vulnerability came up so often when I was talking to the guys. So much of what they were wrestling with was the fear of vulnerability, the desire for vulnerability, the rejection of vulnerability, the embrace of vulnerability. And one of the guys in talking about hookup culture said to me, you know, it's like you're having two very distinct experiences with this other person, and there's not a lot of eye contact, there's not a lot of conversation. And then, you know, it's like you're acting vulnerable, but you're not being vulnerable with someone you don't know or care about very much, which is kind of odd and not really very fun.
Peggy, do you think most of these young men and teenage boys, their parents have any idea how much internet porn is out there, how accessible it is, and how widely used it is? And if your answer is yes or no, tell me, fill us in, how rampant is use of internet pornography by teenage boys?
Well, I want to put a couple of caveats on that. I mean, yes, if you have a teenage boy, I never asked a boy whether he had watched porn. That would have been ridiculous. I asked when he started seeing it. And I want to put a few things out there before we have this discussion. One is, you know, curiosity about sex is completely normal. Masturbation, yay, really great thing to do. And there's all kinds of porn. There's ethically produced porn, there's feminist porn, there's queer porn. But what has changed and what is important for to understand about this generation is not only the internet and the smartphone, but in 2007, Pornhub went online, and that dropped the paywall on the most kind of accessible porn. And so without parents talking to kids, without teachers talking to kids, this has become the de facto sex educator, and it shows this distorted idea of sex as something men do, you know, to women, not with women, as female pleasure as a performance for male satisfaction. You know, bodies are distorted. And we really just have to get in there and talk to kids about what is real and what's not real and what's missing from porn because they are bringing those ideas into the bedroom. And it was actually the number one thing that boys wanted to talk about with me.
But they, even though they realize it's not real, though, it still affects them, right? And affects their relationships.
That's true, you know, with media in general. And you know, it's not just porn. Any media sexual media consumption affects kids. But in general, we all think we're impervious to media, but we're not. What we consume affects our ideas, our beliefs, our thoughts, our feelings, our behaviors. And boys would tell me all the time, I know the difference between, you know, fantasy and reality, but the fact is that research shows that guys who regularly consume porn, college-age guys, are more likely to believe that the behaviors it depicts are real, more likely to want to engage in them, and this is important to understand for guys, they're less satisfied with their actual partnered interactions. They're less satisfied with their own performance. They're less satisfied with their partner's bodies. So, you know, I really hope that the porn chapter in Boys and Sex would help parents see what was going on, but also in a kind of non-judgmental way, allow boys to really understand what is true and what is not true about porn and make their choices around it.
Catherine, your organization hosted Peggy in Portland yesterday. I understand 120 people showed up in a relatively small space. And I'm wondering, does this to you reflect the hunger for a conversation about these issues?
Absolutely. I mean, I think for the 10 years that Speak About It has been speaking about it, that it being consent and sexuality, we have only seen an increase in the amount of people who are down to talk about this or really desire to talk about this. And I think it's across the board. I think it's, yes, it's the young people that are in the classrooms and the auditoriums that we speak with, but it is also their parents. And I think a lot of it, and their teachers and faculty and coaches, and a lot of it has to do with the fact that folks who are my age or above didn't get comprehensive, inclusive, pleasure-based sex education that not only tells us how to keep ourselves safe and healthy, but what goes where and how do you talk about it and how do you treat your partner well and how then do you talk to a young person about that? And so the lack of education across the country, which is something that Peggy covers really extensively in her book as well, has resulted in a deep desire for all of us to learn new skills, to have this conversation with ourselves, with our partners, and with the people we love.
And Peggy, that's the point of your book, right? Is not to shock all of us, but rather to encourage everyone out there to start talking more with their sons and young men in their lives, and with young men to start talking to each other more.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that, you know, the whole the last chapter of the book is very much setting forth a template of the kinds of conversations that we need to have with boys. And I was always struck by what the boys would say to me about our interactions and how, you know, they would say it was cathartic. They would say it was the first time they talked about these things with anybody. There was one scene in the book that's one of my favorites where two boys have a conversation. One, I'm Skyping one, and another guy texts in to ask me a question. And so I ask the boy that I'm Skyping with, you know, what would you say to this boy? And he says what he would say. And they have this whole conversation through me just because of the happenstance of being in a book. But I thought, what if they could have this conversation with the adults that are actually in their lives? And what if they could have it with one another? How transformative would that be?
Well, we are going to take a quick break. We're talking with Peggy Orenstein, the author of the new book, Boys and Sex. Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. You can send an email, a brief email, to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet @MaineCalling, or post a comment on our Facebook page. We'll be right back.
Listener support brings us Maine Calling with help from Modern Pest, focused on providing pest prevention solutions. Learn more at modernpest.com. And Maine Coast Waldorf School in Freeport, presenting a tour of grades 1 through 8 on Wednesday, January 29th. More at mainecoastwaldorf.org.
In the 1890s, Wilmington, North Carolina had a thriving black middle class, a large black electorate, and black representatives in local government. But that ended in 1898 with a bloody campaign of violence and intimidation by white supremacists. On the next Fresh Air, journalist David Zucchino His new book is titled Wilmington's Lie. Join us.
Coming up tonight at 7 o'clock here on Maine Public Radio. Do you have a passion for public media, enjoy working with people, and would like to join a public service mission-driven organization as part of our development team? We'd like to hear from you. You'll be working with others who strongly support and want to help grow Maine Public's shared values of civic engagement, lifelong learning, and public service. For more information, please visit mainepublic.org and click on About and then Careers. Thanks.
Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on the program, we're talking about young men and their attitudes about sex and intimacy. My guest, Peggy Orenstein, best-selling author whose latest book is called Boys and Sex, Young Men on Hookups, Love, Porn, Consent, and Navigating the New Masculinity. Also here, Catherine Buxton, communications manager with the education organization Speak About It. We invite you to join the conversation. Call 1-800-399-3566. Send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. Calling in now is Gibson Fay LeBlanc. He's executive director of the Maine Writers and Publishers Alliance, which co-sponsored Peggy Orenstein's talk in Portland yesterday. He's also a writer, a teacher, and father of a teenage boy. Thanks for joining us, Gibson.
My pleasure. Happy to be here.
You've read Peggy's book and heard her talk about what she's learned from interviewing young men across the country and experts as well. As a father, was there something from Peggy's books that was most concerning to you or stood out to you?
Oh, there were so many things. So I have two boys. I have a teenager, as you said. I have a 14-year-old and an 11-year-old. So two boys who are really kind of either on the cusp or right in the middle of this stuff or about to be. Toward the end of the book, it's like a call to arms, but arms is the wrong word. It's a call to talk, you know, to our boys, to my sons. I love what she says in the book about sort of getting beyond the idea of our sort of old traditional idea of the talk, you know, that one place where we talk about sex with our kids. I think that's an idea that still lingers. And, you know, really we should be, you know, I should be giving my sons opportunities all the time to talk about relationships and sex and questions and things that they're wondering about or feeling awkward about or what have you. And trying to model what good relationships look like.
Yeah, Gibson, thanks so much for calling in. That's Gibson Fay LeBlanc, writer, teacher, and father. Peggy, Gibson says he's 11-year-old and a 14-year-old. One of the things you talk about in your book is how young some of this behavior starts, talking about middle school dances.
And I want to thank Gibson for calling in because, you know, the thing is, fathers or male figures in boys' lives, this is a real opportunity for them to step up as well. And I know that that's hard. I know that it's not how you were parented. And I want to always be really clear that you don't have to be perfect in order to engage in these conversations. You don't have to know all the answers. You don't have to know all the questions. You don't have to have the perfect relationship yourself. You just have to find a place to start. And one of the things that boys said to me most often was that they really wanted to talk to their fathers about these issues. They wanted to hear from their dads about sex. They wanted to hear from their dads about relationships. And they wanted to hear from their dads about their own mistakes and regrets so that they could, you know, try to figure out what they could do better themselves.
I want to mention that if you're hearing a slight popping noise on the air, it is due to a technical glitch in the connection with the Chicago studio. Apologize for that. We're just very lucky to have Peggy with us today from that studio in Chicago. We're going to go to Fred, who's calling from Tenants Harbor. Hi, Fred. Go ahead. You're on Maine Calling.
Thank you. Thank you for the great program. I was glad to hear the word masturbation used and as an okay thing. I call it sexual independence, and it has served me life, has served me well in my life because of trauma in childhood. And so that's what I have to add to the program, and thank you so much.
Catherine.
Thank you so much for saying that. Speak About It talks a lot about, in our consent education programs, talks a lot about learning your own boundaries and desires and learning how to communicate those to other people. And masturbation can often be a really important way for young people to learn about what they like sexually from a young age into their adult life. And it's particularly powerful to tell people of all genders that that is an important and healthy expression of sexuality. And it's something that young people don't often hear and can be considered taboo. And so I appreciate that we're having this honest conversation about it.
Peggy, anything to add to that?
Yeah, I would just say that it's another thing in talking to our kids to think about imaginatively, if you will, because, again, with the advent of free online porn, what I was hearing from boys was that they were from the get-go kind of yoking that cycle of desire, arousal, and release to porn, which, you know, isn't classically addictive, but it's a kind of conditioning effect. And at one point, one boy said to me that there was a guy on his crew team who was legendary because he'd stopped using porn to masturbate. And they said, you know, how do you do that? And he said, well, I use my imagination. And they were like, whoa, you're kidding. Like, it wasn't even a concept. So I would love to see boys not always just be consuming prepackaged fantasies, because I think when you're trying to figure out who you are as a sexual person, what you like, what you want, what you desire, you need to be able to have your own thoughts about that. And as one boy said to me, you know, what porn has really done for us is to take away the ability to go into a sexual experience without those preconceived ideas.
Mm. Fred, thanks for your call. We'll go to Mark, who's calling from Oakland. Hi, Mark. Go ahead.
Hi, thank you for taking my call and for your programs in general. They're great, but I find it troubling when an author on your program interviews such a small number of subjects, in today's example, 100 boys across our country, and then presumes to speak with authority on the subject. I mean, what percent of the young men in our country does that represent? It's tiny. So I think there should be some caution when interviewing people to challenge them to say, how do you know this represents?
Mark, I will give Peggy that question. I probably ought to have note that there are 40 pages of endnotes with all the studies and research that Peggy did in this book, in addition to interviewing the young men and teenagers. But Peggy, do you feel as though the boys you and the young men you interview do represent cross-section of their cohort in America?
I think that, yes, I believe that they do. And I think, you know, that's what journalism is. But what I do in all of my books is to combine the sort of qualitative research that I do and the voices of the boys and the voices of the people that I interview, which are so very important in understanding issues, with undergirded by massive amounts of research and looking at, you know, all kinds of studies on the subject. So, yes, if you look at the endnotes of the book, you will find 40 pages of research, most of which I discuss in the book. But you can look at all the references and draw your own conclusions, I guess.
Catherine.
And just to add to that, one of the big reasons that I feel so honored to be able to chat with Peggy today is because her books, Girls and Sex and now Boys and Sex, have felt so affirming for us at Speak About It. We see that the feedback that we get from students across the country, we've talked to over 60,000 students just this year, the feedback that we get from those students is reflected in some of those individual interviews, those ethnographic interviews that Peggy does when she pairs them with a lot of the research studies, many of which we've also read and base our work on. And so it was a very affirming experience as a consent educator to see that written down and memorialized and explored in these two books.
An email from Fred. This is a rich area indeed, and Ms. Orenstein is doing great work. One voice that's missing at this point is that of adult men. There's something missing when our expectations for boys and young men in matters of intimacy, sex, and love are curated only by women. Shame on us men for waiting for Ms. Orenstein to get the ball rolling. but I'm glad she has. I hope to see men chiming in. Are you hearing this as you travel the country on your book tour, Peggy?
Yeah, and it's, you know, one of the reasons that I was concerned about doing a book like this was because I was a woman, and I thought, oh, maybe an adult man should do this book, but nobody was. So, you know, there's great organizations that are run by men, run by women, run by all kinds of people in between and beyond, that are stepping up now to support boys. But it was interesting to do this as a woman because I worried that guys, you know, maybe wouldn't talk to me. And I tried different things. I would ask boys to interview one another. I would ask boys to interview their brothers. I would ask young women to interview boys. I did all kinds of stuff to see what would happen if I changed it up. But I began feeling after a while that maybe for everything that they might possibly not have told me because I was a woman, and frankly, I don't think there was a lot they didn't tell me, but there was probably also something that they did tell me because for that very reason, because they could drop that mask, they could drop that pose, they could go off the box when they were talking to a woman.
And for our main audiences, I want to make sure that I give you a really important resource here for particularly men. Here in Maine, we have an organization called Maine Boys to Men, which is an incredible organization that's doing scientifically studied and proven to be effective work in schools with young people on gender and violence. But they also host programs for adult men. So if this is a conversation for you that is interesting, has sparked something in you that you would like to do something more about, please seek out Maine Boys to Men. Check out their programs for adults. Check out to see if they have a program in your kid's school. They're a really incredible resource.
We'll go to Alex, who's calling from Scarborough. Hi, Alex. Go ahead.
Hi, everybody. Thank you for this great discussion. I just wanted to put a word in for the fact that I feel like our society is so squeamish, and I don't understand when we had a sexual revolution in this country and we consider ourselves so avant-garde and ahead, but actually so many European countries are much more forthcoming, allow their children to have these conversations. When I was a young child, my Italian mother allowed me to go to movies with her, often in foreign languages, but it would often predicate a conversation about relationships, sexuality, at a pretty young age, and she didn't hide anything from us. I also learned a lot about sexuality through the arts. And as an arts educator, I cannot talk to my college students with any without being censored about any imagery that involves nudity or even a glimmer of eroticism. It's considered triggery. It's considered dangerous, possibly harassment. Can you guys address that issue, that we adults cannot help our students or our young people in conversation? We're not allowed.
Peggy.
Thank you.
Yeah, I can speak to... Sure, I can speak to some of that, which is that, yeah, our kids grow up in a media that is saturated with commodified, transactional sexual imagery, and yet we don't talk to them about how to have a mutually gratifying, personally fulfilling sexual and romantic relationship. It is just bizarre. I don't think that we would be so silent on any other topic that was so central to our young people's well-being. And other countries do a much better job in girls and sex more than in boys and sex. I talk about the example of the Dutch. And there's a study that where they compared female college students in demographically similar female college students in Holland and America and found that the Dutch girls had everything we say we want. You know, they had lower rates of STDs, lower rates of pregnancy. They were more likely to have enjoyed their early experiences. They knew their partner very well. They were sober at the time, you know, everything. And when they talked to them more deeply, they found that the Dutch had said that their parents, teachers, and doctors had talked to them from an early age about sex, about love, and about the importance of pleasure. And, you know, in America, we frame all discussions about sex in terms of risk and danger. And that made me really think about the shift to talking about responsibility and joy.
Thank you, Alex, for your call. We are going to do another quick break. When we come back, more of this conversation about boys, sex, sexuality, sexual intimacy on Maine Calling.
Listener support brings us Maine Calling with help from Breakwater Curiosity for Life, offering exceptional day school and after-school options for toddlers through 8th grade. BreakwaterLearning.org. By Marshall Communications with Nancy Marshall's The PR Maven podcast, offering advice on building your brand and network. MarshallPR.com. And Savvy Event Rental with Tidewater Sailcloth Tents, handcrafted farm tables, walnut crossback chairs, and more. SavvyEventRental.com.
On This Day in Maine's History is brought to you in partnership with the Maine Historical Society.
On January 13, 1966, actor Patrick Dempsey was born in Lewiston. Dempsey dropped out of high school to tour as a juggler and magician before he found his calling in the acting field. He began his career on stage but made the transition to television in the 1990s. He started the Patrick Dempsey Center for Cancer Hope and Healing in his hometown after his mother developed cancer. The Dempsey Challenge is now recognized around the globe.
Visit MainePublic.org to explore all the ways that Maine Public is celebrating Maine's bicentennial. Happy birthday, Maine!
Coming up on the next Commonwealth Club program, consumers and policymakers alike are increasingly calling for the big technology companies to take responsibility for the disruptions caused by the digital revolution. Join us as Microsoft President Brad Smith addresses those concerns and calls for new approaches from the world of high tech on the next Commonwealth Club radio program.
Coming up shortly after Maine Calling at 2 o'clock here on Maine Public Radio.
Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You're listening to Maine Calling. Today on the program, the behaviors and attitudes of boys and young men regarding sex. My guests are Catherine Buxton with Speak About It and Peggy Orenstein, author of the new book, Boys and Sex. Join our conversation at 1-800-399-3566. Joining us on the line now is Theo Green. He's an assistant professor of sociology at Bowdoin College. Thanks for calling in, Theo.
Oh, I'm glad to be here.
I understand you're planning to use material from Peggy's book in your classes on masculinity and sexuality. You teach young men who are similar in age to those she interviewed. Do your students talk about the same kind of concerns she includes in her book?
I absolutely am teaching the book. I'm very excited to teach it, not just in my sexualities class, my intro to sociology classes as well. And the reason why I do that is because I don't think the men, the college students that I'm encountering are having these conversations. I think that's part of the problem. And so, bringing studies like Peggy's into the classroom is really essential for me to have these kinds of conversations and in the ways in which I think the concerns of the men Peggy studies are framed.
Can you talk about your thoughts on sort of the dismissiveness of some of the culture around sexual assault or this predatory behavior on how men are still raised often with the idea of, boys will be boys?
That whole boys will be boys ideology is such an old way of thinking about sexuality that goes back to the early 20th century where, we often believe that men had all this testosterone and they have to have these outlets for, their sexual energies to be directed. And it's become so ingrained in our society today that I think, we take it for granted, the role of trying to socialize, I think, these young men into being productive and active citizens. I think to your other question, though, about this sort of dismissive attitude, I think that also arises from the product of being a part of an androcentric society where we're focusing on men's sexuality to the point where, we often construct these questions of consent around male subjectivity and male pleasure.
Mm. Peggy, I'm wondering, as you're listening to Theo, if you have thoughts on what he's saying.
Excited that he's teaching the book. Thank you so much. What Theo's talking about is a kind of the way that boys learn growing up to put their pleasure before girls' feelings in a sexual encounter, and particularly if they are drunk, which in hookup culture is kind of the is compulsory. They tend to overperceive yes. In some studies that have asked what signs boys have had that a girl was sexually interested in them, there are things that only appear once. The only thing they have in common is that they were all perceived as interest. So any expression of friendliness when drunk can become a yes. They underperceive no. They don't are less likely to see a partner's hesitation. There's the concern that boys will see consent to consent to one act as consent to everything, or consent is about place. If somebody says they're going to go home with you, that constitutes consent. That's not true. So helping boys not only having these kind of like the so-called sex talk, but understanding media, understanding gender dynamics, understanding all these issues and how they play into our ideas about masculinity and about relationships. So again, that we can stress the positive ultimately and help keep the idea of the long game, which is how do we help young people have knowledgeable, consensual, ethical, good, mutually gratifying relationships.
Theo, before we let you go, what are your thoughts on how we as a society need to change the way we socialize boys?
I think that the key here is often thinking about how the issues I think Peggy raises in her book are longstanding ways about how we think about raising boys as boys. And that is in terms of the kinds of values of competition, the values of the kind of violent play that young boys actually cultivate, right, as early as like preschool and kindergarten when they're starting to socialize with one another. And so that kind of rethinking in terms of moving beyond this kind of hyper-competition, this kind of, you know, this notion of this sort of violence that sort of then manifests itself as people get older and produce this kind of contemporary crisis of masculinity, we have to start it at a very early age, and we have to continue to develop it and reinforce, these values often.
Well, Theo, thanks so much for calling in today. Theo Green teaches sociology at Bowdoin College. I want to go to an email from Stephen with a different point of view. He writes, "I'm an adult man and I want to weigh in. I think these values are terrible. The Bible says there are only two genders. Sex is for marriage between male and female alone, and our feelings the wrong way to determine right and wrong. Sex problems will be reduced when we raise our children so that their emotional maturity more closely corresponds with sexual maturity and that we get them married earlier." Peggy.
Well, I think regardless of where you are on the spectrum of how you feel about when sexual contact should happen between young people, they still need to have the education that we're talking about what makes for a mutually gratifying relationship, about what makes for consensual sex, about what makes for ethical sex, about the lies that they're sold by the media. I don't think that changes regardless of your personal family values, but that is definitely a personal family value and not something that I would agree should be something that we practice culture-wide, obviously.
Catherine.
Yeah, I want to agree with Peggy and talk a lot about value. So when we speak to parents, we often talk about how when talking with their young people, they should talk at a young age about the values in which they want to live their lives. And so talking with your kids about sex, about sexuality, about relationships is a values conversation. And you need to give young people all the information out there about what their body does, what it feels, in order for them to make informed, valued-based decisions for themselves. And so those conversations do need to start at a young age. And kids are receiving information about sex from a very, very young age, regardless of whether they're getting it from the Bible or school or the media. And I think this conversation of pleasure, regardless of where you stand on sort of the social or political spectrum, is a really important conversation to have. We all want kids to honor their partners, whether that is in a marriage relationship, whether that's in a hookup, et cetera. We want them to treat each other like human beings, to feel good, to prioritize the other person's pleasure and safety and happiness. And so I think that is a universally held value. And we've talked to lots of parents who agree with Steve, who are much more progressive, who don't want to have conversations with their kids about sex, all sorts of parents. And they, I've not heard a single parent who doesn't want healthy relationships for their child.
We'll go to Ellery calling from Waterville. Hi, Ellery. Go ahead.
Yes. Hello. A much overdue topic, really. So great. One of the speakers just a short while ago mentioned about how a sexual relationship or something of that nature is something we do with someone rather than to someone. That's critical. I've been using that expression for ages, and it opens people's eyes for some reason. They don't get it. My question, quickly. I know it's not a talk per se or how to determine when that should occur. I thought of it was mostly a conversation that started with a male early on. And as the male grew, the increasing detail, situations, whatnot, grew as the conversations grow. So, but is there really a guideline as when that conversation should begin? How do you determine? Because males just seem to age so greatly different from one another.
Yeah, thanks, Ellery. Do you have, Catherine, thoughts on when to start talking with some, you know, explicit and detailed language to your son?
Absolutely. So these conversations about sex and sexuality are honestly conversations about relationship and bodily autonomy. And so we can start having conversations that precede the sex talk and precede the more anatomical conversations at truly young ages. So at 3 or 4, you can start to teach your kid good touch, bad touch, yes or no, asking consent or permission for hugs. Those are all things that kids can understand. Teaching kids the accurate terminology for their different body parts, teaching kids what different body parts do, and engaging that bodily curiosity is a totally healthy and appropriate thing to do with even, you know, kindergartners or younger. And then as young people grow, starting to talk about what does it look like to be a good friend? What is the golden rule? We all learned that in school. How can we apply that to friendships? What does respect look like? So these are things we can kind of scaffold one on top of the other. And when it comes time where kids are a little more naturally curious about sex, boys as young as 8 oftentimes will see pornography for the first time, trying to precede some of that conversation with a knowledge-based conversation, with questions rather than just come in and hot with answers. Those are all really appropriate things to start at a young age, even prior to when they will eventually be sexually active later in life.
Ellery, thanks for your call. We have an email here from Louise. When my son was in middle school, I had a conversation with the principal asking about young men and their exposure to porn. He confirmed that a very high percentage of male students were exposed and that the widespread use of smartphones meant it was widely, easily, and covertly shared. After some research, I learned about curricula and media that helped to start and direct the conversation around this subject and male sexuality in general for boys. When I reached out to parents, a group of 30-plus via email, I heard from only 2. One was furious that I'd suggested such a thing and told me to never contact them again. The other said I was making a mountain out of a molehill. I would say parental denial is the biggest problem in relation to this topic, and that it results in badly skewed ideas and expectations, as has been discussed. It's the starting point for toxic masculinity. We can and should change this. Peggy.
Well, yes. You know, everything that she said, yes, absolutely. I think that parents really have to get in there. And again, we don't have the luxury of silence around this. And around the pornography question, I guess I feel like if you're a parent and you haven't looked at Pornhub and, you know, you're an adult, you can do what you want. But you should, because if you've got like 70s porn in your head, you're really understanding what your kids are looking at and what they're being influenced by. And again, when they don't have a counter narrative, you know, we've done a much better job with girls, I think, because we understand the harm that media messages do to our daughters. But we need to get in and develop that counter narrative with our boys so that they too can have that critical lens and really understand and resist what's harmful about the messages in the media they consume.
An email from Lewis. I'm in my late 50s, and once you get hooked on porn, it's for life. I've gone through life thinking that if you talk to a girl, it should automatically lead to sex, which comes from porn. The guys that abuse women are scum, but guys that just hit on women don't mean anything by it. They just want to have sex.
That's a really interesting perspective, and I want to thank the person for being open with that question and comment. I think something that Peggy addresses really well in the book is the way in which people can interpret yes. Young men in particular can take a lot of bodily cues to say yes. And what we say about affirmative consent, this idea that consent has to be voluntary, freely given, enthusiastic and reaffirmed through every step of a process, is that just because somebody looks at you and seems to be flirting doesn't mean they automatically want to have sex with you. And these messages, I'm not blaming anyone for thinking that misconception is true. That's the messages that we've been getting from a lot of media. And so I think it's the work of all of us to recondition ourselves to understand truly how consent works, and that the conversations that happen prior to a sexual encounter are multifaceted, and that you have to make sure you're getting yes every step of the way. And yes, porn does not give us an accurate depiction of what affirmative consent looks like. So we have to build those scripts and skills in young people and people of all ages to recognize consent, ask for it, and honor it.
Peggy, you write about the narcissism of male desire, that men interpret women's behavior through the filter of their own wishes.
Mm-hmm. And that's sort of what we're talking about here, is that sense of over-perceiving yes and under-perceiving hesitation. And to me, in a lot of ways, that's why in the Me Too revelations, the Aziz Ansari story was really interesting. And you can argue that it was irresponsibly reported, but I think the dynamics that it revealed between men and women were something to really discuss with young people, and the ways that, you know, she continues to try to please. She keeps wanting to make it okay. And he's just like another overeager dude who sees a young woman's limits as a challenge that he's supposed to overcome.
Peggy, what do you hope your book does?
Well, I hope it starts the kind of conversation we're having today. Truly. I mean, I really do. What I want for this, and what I wanted for Girls and Sex, and what it did, was open conversation among parents, between parents and young people. And, you know, a young friend of mine who's in Portland, a teenager, a girl, said to me, what I hope is that this book helps boys who read it get beyond guy talk and start opening a more meaningful dialogue with their peers and even within themselves.
Well, thank you so much for joining us today. That's Peggy Orenstein, a best-selling author whose latest book is Boys and Sex, Young Men on Hookups, Love, Porn Consent, and Navigating the New Masculinity. Also here with me, Catherine Buxton, communication manager for Speak About It. Sandra Harris ran the board today. Maine Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. We will have all sorts of resources available on our website. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.